Collier's Encyclopedia, in collaboration with the worldwide facilities of Radio Press International, presents Year in Sound, 1965 edition. This is Bill Scott inviting you to listen to the voices and events that made the news in 1964. Inviting you to hear the news, the personalities, the world leaders, expressing themselves on important issues. The sounds of the year, in a personal and penetrating close-up in the modern dimension of living sound. ...1964 may be called the year in which the post-war era ended, and the world embarked on a new course, a course as yet undefined, but charted by this knowledge. Science has given man the power to prolong and enrich life, and to end it, swiftly, in a single stroke. In 1963, the sounds of the news had overtones of tragedy and death. Here are some of the sounds of the news of 1964... Not all soothing, but generally less ominous, and reflecting more caution.
Firmness will always be measured.
South Carolina cast 16 votes for Senator Barry Goldwater to put him over the top.
I want the American people to know that I am the greatest.
In nuestro encuentro con la India.
Let us get together, unite, plan a program of activity, and the program, and we'll win.
Listen now to the stories behind these sounds. On 1964, Year in Review.
I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. And let me remind you also that moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue.
This is not a conservative philosophy. This is not even a Republican philosophy. This is not a philosophy ever embraced by any major American leader. Conservative may be written on their banner and in their books, but radical is in their hearts.
The choices may have seemed simple. Behind them were 1,000 implications. This is Steve Nevis reporting on a campaign that began in February on the frozen turf of a political proving ground called the state of New Hampshire. Voters in the nation's first presidential primary were interested enough in the issues. The candidates didn't impress them very much.
If I'm not the nominee, I'll still be rich as Rockefeller. Water at my feet on the extreme right side of the street.
So the Republicans of New Hampshire gave their convention votes to a man on the other side of the world, U.S. Ambassador to South Vietnam Henry Cabot Lodge. In April, Senator Goldwater began gaining ground in the race for the Republican nomination. His years of nationwide campaigning for party candidates and the conservative cause were paying off. When the Republican Platform Committee met in San Francisco during the week before the party convention in July, increasingly bitter differences between conservatives and the party's old line moderates caused an explosion. They agreed on nothing, and the platform went to an open convention where Governor Rockefeller sought a plank condemning extremism.
It is essential that this convention repudiate here and now any doctrine. Doctrinaire, militant minority, whether communist, Ku Klux Klan, or Bircher.
He lost. The Goldwaterites prevailed as well on civil rights and nuclear policy. Nominee Goldwater chose Congressman William Miller for a running mate, and party unity became their immediate problem. The kind of unity Barry Goldwater and Bill Miller obtained was minimal, failing to extend beyond agreement that Republicans were, after all, Republicans. While the extremism issue shattered Republican solidarity, the iceberg-like qualities of the civil rights problem threatened the Democrats 1 month later in Atlantic City. Their virulent feelings were contained by the Credentials Committee, before which Mississippi's Freedom Democratic Party fought for recognition in place of the state's all-white delegation, while Alabamans joined their brethren in refusing to swear loyalty to the national ticket. No one was satisfied with the solution, but the South, it seemed, was lost to Senator Goldwater anyway. So the party maintained the course to which it was committed, nominating civil rights strategist Senator Hubert Humphrey for the vice presidency. Maybe the Democratic Party was holding together because of the tragedy it, with the nation, had suffered. That feeling built up to the convention's final night when Robert Kennedy, who had just stepped into the New York senatorial race under crossfire of carpetbagging charges, stood on the platform to thank his party for what it had done for his brother. Robert Kennedy fighting back the tears to speak over the ovation.
I first want to thank all of you for all that you did for President John F. Kennedy. I realize that as an individual, that we can't just look back, that we must look forward. When I think of President Kennedy, I think of what Shakespeare said in Romeo and Juliet, when he shall die, take him and cut him out in little stars, and he shall make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with night and pay no worship to the garish sun.
The campaign was like trench warfare, the protagonists never seeing each other because President Johnson preferred not to debate. Senator Goldwater on the offensive would lob a charge at the president, who would, at his leisure, try to disarm it. The tone of the campaign was fixed at the outset.
We believe in the individual. We believe that men can govern themselves. And they can best do these things without the restraints of dictatorship or paternalism.
I'm not one that thinks that you can just ignore this general subject of education, or that you can ignore this general subject of poverty and just say, well, if they're poor, they ought to have done better for themselves. I want the government to be a compassionate government and an understanding government and a government that wants to do something about them.
But nuclear responsibility became the major issue.
We could find ourselves in the 70s without a single one of the flexible manned weapons which give us the vital scale of a controlled, graduated deterrent rather than only a capacity for all-out intercontinental nuclear confrontation.
Loose charges on nuclear weapons without any shadow of justification by any candidate for any office, let alone the presidency, are a disservice to our national security.
The Republican nominee had been repeatedly charging the president with responsibility for Bobby Baker's misdoings. But Mr. Johnson didn't flinch until the GOP uncovered the arrest of his close aide, Walter Jenkins, for immorality. Senator Goldwater promised not to mention the Jenkins case unless it affected national security, but drew derisive laughter wherever he went by describing the president's staff as that curious crew. Mr. Johnson was astonished, then depressed, as he seemed to shed his self-confident campaign style for one more angry and determined.
Extremism in the pursuit of the presidency is an unpardonable bias. And moderation in the affairs of the nation is the highest virtue.
Suddenly it was over, though, and Lyndon Johnson's campaign theme took on new urgency after the landslide became apparent that night in Austin.
Our purpose must be to bind up our wounds, to heal our history, and to make this nation whole.
Senator Goldwater's concession statement was more like a battle cry.
This effort that we engaged in last January the 3rd turns out to be a much longer effort than we thought. It's not an effort that we can drop now, nor do we have any intentions of dropping it now.
He meant to hang on to the reins of the party organization. Other Republicans surveying the rubble had different ideas about removing National Chairman Dean Burch, finding new leadership, and about each other. Next, Herb Brubaker reviews the presidency in 1964, Year in Review. For Lyndon Johnson, it was continuation and innovation, challenges of a new Western world and an old totalitarian threat. This is Herb Brubaker, Radio Press International's White House correspondent. Kennedy's foreign policy was continued. Mr. Johnson sought also to improve contacts with European nations showing dissatisfaction with Soviet policies.
We must develop with our allies new means of bridging the gap between the East and the West. We shall neither act as aggressors nor tolerate acts of aggression. We intend to bury no one, and we do not intend to be buried.
Continued was John Kennedy's measured response. When Fidel Castro cut the water supply to the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo,
water can be brought in and will be brought in indefinitely from Fort Everglades, Florida.
And when Castro offered a limited supply, the president ordered Guantanamo's commander to cut the pipe. The measured response. When North Vietnamese PT boats attacked U.S. destroyers in the Tonkin Gulf's international waters,
air action is now in execution against gunboats and certain supporting facilities in North Vietnam, which have been used in these hostile operations.
Defense Secretary Robert McNamara comments on the mission's outcome.
The airstrike very clearly made clear to the North Vietnamese our intention to maintain our right to operate on the high seas. That was the objective, I think, that has been accomplished.
The North Vietnamese superior guerrilla tactics combined with unstable government in Saigon made Washington's job frustrating and sometimes seemingly hopeless. But like his predecessor, Lyndon Johnson believed South Vietnam's loss could mean communist victory throughout Southeast Asia. When communist China exploded her first nuclear device, President Johnson said this.
Until this week, only four powers had entered the dangerous world of nuclear explosions. Whatever their differences, all four are sober and serious states with long experience as major powers in the modern world. Communist China has no such experience. Its nuclear pretensions are both expensive and cruel to its people.
As did John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson exercised presidential patience in working for freedom. In the difficult war in Cyprus, where Greek and Turkish factions fought, in Panama, where anti-American riots erupted, where there were demands for a new canal treaty, U.S.-Panamanian relations were severed. For almost 4 months, the president worked on reopening communications, then agreement.
We will reestablish diplomatic relations. We will immediately appoint special ambassadors with sufficient powers to seek the prompt elimination of the causes of conflict between the two countries without limitations or preconditions of any kind.
Presidential patience in seeking expansion of the limited nuclear test ban.
We're proposing that both sides stop all production of the fissionable material that is used in nuclear weapons.
Presidential patience in refusing to draw rash conclusions when Khrushchev was ousted and Kosygin and Brezhnev took over the Kremlin. Mr. Johnson counseled free world unity while the West awaited Moscow developments. But unity there was not. One reason, a plan conceived by the Kennedy administration, continued by Mr. Johnson, the multilateral nuclear force, a NATO surface fleet manned by multi-nation crews. De Gaulle, seeking French hegemony in Europe, opposed the idea. British Prime Minister Harold Wilson, fearing the plan would give the West Germans nuclear weapons secrets, had his doubts. With the exception of West Germany, NATO nations were cool to the idea. But President Johnson persisted, called Wilson to the White House, extended a royal welcome. When it was over, Wilson gave his views.
They've been what I hoped for. Not only friendly, but practical, getting down to cases and tackling each problem effectually and frankly, without frills. No theology, but a fast-moving, urgent, and down-to-earth approach to everything we discussed.
Continued was Kennedy humanitarianism when the U.S. joined Belgium in the Congo rescue mission. In domestic affairs, the president continued John Kennedy's commitment to civil rights, fought hard for passage of the historic equal opportunity legislation, the major Johnson innovation. For the first time in generations, a Democratic president got along with businessmen. And yet the president sometimes lectured them like a Dutch uncle.
Your task and mine is to make sure that that government functions, not to obstruct. I ask you what would happen to your business if each day your stockholders, and that's what you are, this government, spent all day long, like one or two of them do sometimes at an annual board meeting, criticizing what you do and finding fault with everything you do and resolute against you every day. Just fast those mimeographs can turn them out.
A major reason for the Johnson business rapport was the president's emphasis on government frugality. He trimmed the budget to $97.2 billion. And Defense Secretary McNamara took this move, saving the government an estimated $500 million yearly.
We've identified 95 surplus, obsolete, unneeded facilities. These can be eliminated without in any way reducing our military strength or our combat readiness.
While the president made points with business, he impressed the poor with his war on poverty.
Our aim is not only to relieve the symptom of poverty, but to cure it, and above all, to prevent it.
While the president's policies kept alive the Kennedy image, the Warren Commission evoked a bitter memory. After months of investigation, it issued a voluminous report. Commission member Gerald Ford, Michigan Republican congressman, cites the commission's conclusion that Lee Harvey Oswald was the assassin. And he adds,
there was no evidence found by the commission that proved a conspiracy, either foreign or domestic. Oswald acted alone based on what evidence we found.
Among other things, the commission recommended tighter presidential security, yet the nation feared for the president's security as he campaigned across the land, repeating his theme, "Let us continue." Continuation and innovation, the story of the presidency, 1964. Next, Don Folsom takes a look at the United States Congress in 1964, year in review.
The second session of the 88th Congress was good to Lyndon Johnson, responding affirmatively to nearly all of the new president's legislative requests. This is Don Folsom, Radio Press International's Capitol Hill correspondent. The administration's Medicare proposal, though passed by the Senate, died in the House. Its aid to Appalachia plan met a similar fate. But these were the only significant setbacks, and they were viewed as temporary. The president's congressional triumphs, however, were many, and at least two resulted in historic legislation, the biggest federal income tax cut and the most comprehensive Civil Rights Act. Neither bill was approved without a fight. Tennessee's Albert Gore led Senate opposition to the tax reduction proposal.
I'd like to kill it. It's a bad bill. It's a very unfair bill in that it gives the largest benefits to those who need it least. I will try to amend the bill in several ways to make a better bill out of a bad bill.
No crippling changes were made, and by February 26th, Congress had completed action on the bill, which reduced individual and corporate income taxes by $11.5 billion. The measure's Senate floor manager, Russell Long of Louisiana, then declared,
"This is the culmination of 1 year's work in the Congress by the House and the Senate. It is the largest revenue bill in the history of the country. This will be a bill not to tax the American people, but to untax them, and I'm happy to have played a part in that."
The Civil Rights Bill had a dedicated champion in its Senate floor manager, Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota.
Really, what we're arguing about and what the contest is about is the recognition of and the respect for human dignity. And until the United States of America strikes down segregation, and until we remove from our thinking and our practice bigotry and discrimination and prejudice, we have not fulfilled our obligation.
Passage of the 11-point anti-bias package was no easy accomplishment. It took 83 days in the Senate. Filibustering Southerners were led by Georgia's Richard Russell.
This is one of the most severe bills that has ever been presented to the Congress and is undoubtedly the most massive assault that has ever been made by statutory legislation on our constitutional system.
There was enough support for the measure if only it could be brought to a vote. It finally was. For the first time in the Senate's history, on June 10th, cloture was invoked on a civil rights debate. Late in the year, the Supreme Court upheld as constitutional the controversial public accommodation section of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. It was a case of the high bench agreeing with the Congress. The two branches don't always get along as well, as was evident after the court handed down its landmark one man, one vote ruling, which said that both houses of a bicameral state legislature must be apportioned on a population basis. Republican congressional leaders Everett Dirksen and Charles Halleck wanted the decision overturned.
Of course, abuses of geographic representation exist in some state legislatures and should be remedied. But is this the way to do it? We say emphatically no.
We Republicans believe the historic geographic population legislative balance, which has protected minority rights and interests for 175 years, should be maintained. We intend to support a constitutional amendment, if necessary, to rectify the Supreme Court's decision.
The House passed a bill denying federal courts apportionment jurisdiction. In the Senate, Dirksen attached to the foreign aid money bill a rider delaying reapportionment decisions. But liberals mounted a baby filibuster, forcing acceptance of a compromise sense of Congress resolution, which was later scrapped by a joint conference committee. And President Johnson, who had taken no stand on the touchy reapportionment matter, was given substantially what he had proposed for an overseas assistance budget, $3.5 billion. The chief executive also received close to $1 billion in congressional funds to begin his ambitious project to alleviate domestic poverty. Aside from appropriating money and making laws, Congress often investigates, or at least tries to.
Today's proceedings are an unconstitutional invasion by the legislative branch into the proper function of the judiciary.
Bobby Baker had somehow become a millionaire, by his own estimate, on a Senate salary of $19,500 a year. The Senate Rules Committee was charged with finding out if Baker had used his influential position as Majority Secretary in making the quick climb to wealth. In February, and again in December, Baker was called before the panel in public session. The results were the same each time.
I invoke the protection of the First, the Fourth, the Fifth, and the Sixth Amendments of the Constitution, and I specifically invoke the privilege against self-incrimination.
By year's end, the probe seemed to have raised as many questions as it had answered, and the hearings had become filled with partisan bickering and even shouting matches among investigators.
You will not be bothered with me again in your Rules Committee.
Well, you ought to at least tell the truth.
That statement you've made is absolutely untrue. Now, wait a minute. This is the first time in my life that an employee of a Senate committee in a public hearing has accused a senator of an untruth. Mr. McClendon had no business making such statement. I hope that he withdraws. I had the same business making that statement. He has. Senator Williams, how you have making his.
John Williams, whose private detective work sparked the inquiry, had been sitting in on the hearings as an interested observer. But the Delaware Republican became disgusted with the way the committee was handling the probe and decided to take a walk.
I'm not walking out of here with any thought that I'm losing interest in this case. I have had my integrity challenged twice this week. The first time I overlooked it, I always give the man the second opportunity. But no man gets the third opportunity to call me a liar.
Hearings were also held on the other side of the Capitol. The House Committee on Un-American Activities looked into an unauthorized trip to Cuba by a group of American students, but didn't learn very much from the uncooperative and sometimes rude witnesses.
I feel that these gentlemen are out to disrupt American society. And
My rudeness was as a matchbox to the Empire State Building compared to their rudeness toward me.
A government report prompted another House hearing. U.S. Surgeon General Luther Terry, in making known the Public Health Service's findings on the relationship between cigarette smoking and lung cancer, had these recommendations.
I would advise anyone to cut to discontinue smoking cigarettes. But if he were to continue smoking cigarettes, he should do so in appreciation of the health hazard.
The Committee on Interstate and Foreign Commerce held hearings on the matter, which turned into a forum for the tobacco industry after Dr. Terry announced that cigarette labeling and advertising regulations would be put into effect in 1965. Next, Noel Bernard reviews the year in Europe and Asia.